everybody. Mary, Culkin, Keatonus again. Aaron and Jim are back. I'm speaking to third person about another Christmas movie that we just live watched. Now we're going to do an officially unofficial review of the 1990 Macaulay Culkin vehicle. Mm-hmm. John Hughes produced, Chris Columbus directed.
John Williams scored.
Home Alone.
Uh-huh.
One of my personal favorite holiday movies. I was surprised, and maybe we can talk about this a little bit later, that that is not a universal opinion. I was like, one of my favorite things to do when I'm going and doing, like, you know, commission podcasts or these, like, you know, retrospective podcasts is to go and look at a Roger Ebert review. Because, you know, it's like my views and his lineup 95% of the time.
Yeah.
But this is one of the rare things where not only did I think he was wrong, but, like, he seemed wrong-headed and wrong-spirited. Yeah. Like, it's a bad faith review of the movie.
Absolutely. I think he completely misses the mark for reasons we'll discuss. He must have been, like, having a bad day. Like, him and Siskel fought on set or something.
Maybe.
Because that's what they do.
But it's not a... even a minority opinion. Like, if you look at this on Rotten Tomatoes, it's like 63%. If you look at this on Metacritic, it's like 5.2 out of 10.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of Home Alone hate out there.
That's just wrong.
Yeah.
I feel like if you don't like this movie, you're not in the right spirit.
Okay.
Or you have never been a young child. A mischievous child.
Right.
Because this movie is set up perfectly for those young, mischievous kids.
And I've been on the other end of, like, a controversial opinion. Like, I remember the first time I saw Love Actually, and I
thought you were going to say Lost.
No, the first time I saw, it turns out anything that starts with L, I can't stand. An L-O, it's like...
yeah, forget about it.
Lost in Translation can just go fuck itself. Fuck itself. It's amazing. Murray or Johansson had a career after that piece of shit. Anyway, I don't even remember what
Welcome to the Home Alone podcast.
Welcome to the Home Alone podcast. I saw Love Actually, and I'm like, I fucking don't see why everyone thinks this is a heartwarming movie about love, or B, something that's, like, good and fun to watch at Christmas time. And it's interesting, as the last 10 years, I feel like that's starting to become a mainstream view, or at least, like, a sizable minority opinion, but, like, I don't know. Like, it feels like there's a bunch of Home Alone haters, and
I'm
not one of them.
I mean, maybe we should talk now, since we're on the subject, about why Ebert's wrong on this review.
Do you want to do that, or do we want to do? Okay, yeah, let's do it. Let's do it, because
this review is the fantasy of every mischievous kid who has ever set a booby trap or thought about setting a booby trap,
right?
And it's not about whether or not this story is believable to you as an old man reviewing movies, reviewing your 600th movie.
Right.
It's about what that kid thinks. And that kid has thought about every single one of these booby traps, but couldn't carry them out. And this is that power fantasy.
Right.
For that child. I think it's amazing in that regard.
Yeah, and I mean, he's also kind of, like, not surprisingly kind of, like, lukewarm on the Goonies. Like, the things he was saying, like, he's like, I get it. This violence is, like, Three Stooges slapstick. I'm like, do you?
Yeah, you wouldn't be criticizing it
because
if you got that.
Because you then go and talk about the graphic violence and how it's, like, a slasher fic with the kid. And I'm like, what the fuck are you going on about? And no child could repel two determined criminals from his home.
Not.
But I feel like you got to give him a little credit for, like, it's plausible. Like, he's not...
I don't even think that matters. I think it's all about what the kid has in his head.
That's right. You're like, absolutely right.
Like, the kid is the important thing here, and the kid is having a blast. Like, this is a thrill.
Like, if you think that a kid is going to watch this movie and think... I mean, I don't know. On the one hand, like, would it surprise me to read that some 7-year-old has thrown a can of paint at somebody and killed them? Like, okay, maybe not. But, like, that's probably a failure of parenting for explaining the difference between reality and fantasy. I just don't think... I mean, like, it's Looney Tunes. It's It's Elmer Fudd hunting Bugs Bunny with Macaulay Culkin being the Bugs Bunny.
Yep.
And, you know, like, yeah, I guess if you if Joe Pesci literally had his head strapped down a blowtorch, it'd be horrific. But it doesn't even faze him because he's a cartoon character.
Right.
But no one breaks bones. No one does anything more than lose their gold tooth and get sent to prison. I read the arguments of these of this person that I admire and respect, and it's just like, not only is he wrong, but he just has like, he's not just factually wrong. He's like wrong from a emotional level. And and Roger Ebert's the first one to be like, Dark Material's okay for kids because, you know, it's okay for kids to be uncomfortable and sad and all this stuff. But, like, it's not okay for kids to watch, like, a zany, I don't know. It's like a kid's going to lose his mind and shoot up a school because he watched Daniel Stern step on a 6-inch nail.
Right.
Get the fuck out of here with that.
Yeah, I can't imagine. He just doesn't seem to be approaching it from the right perspective in my mind.
So. Yeah, and like there's just like you can search, like if you search for like Home Alone reviews, there's just like these endless moral panics of like, what will children think if they see this and they just hurt adults?
You know what?
And
I'm one of those kids who saw it.
Right, right.
I mean, I'm not arrested for murdering people. I'm not arrested for killing my parents with paint buckets.
No.
Nothing like that. I have to say, though, watching this movie, damn, did I want to go home and put up some booby traps.
Sure.
But my booby traps were like, confetti's going to drop on your head when you open this door.
But it could have been boiling pitch.
It could have been. Yeah, I just didn't have access, I guess.
That's the thing.
To the boiling pitch. The tar and the feathers and the nails.
Do you think there's anything persuasive about, like, the fact that Joe Pesci, he grabs the hot thing and he burns his hand, but then he has, like, a permanent, like, hideously scarred M burnt into his palm. Like, I get it that some of this stuff is graphic. So I'm because, you know, that's the thing I like to do. I like to understand the other person's opinion, but, like, I don't. Again, like, how is that any different than, like, Daffy Duck getting his bill blown to the backside of his head by a shotgun to the face?
Yep.
Like, either that is acceptable forms of societal entertainment and escapism, or it's not. And you kind of have to be, you know, like, I don't see how you can be like, you know what, the Three Stooges are doing is one thing, and Looney Tunes is one thing, but this is above, you know, like, why? Because you were 6 when you saw Bugs Bunny get his face blown off, you're 55 when you see, you know, Macaulay Culkin do it?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, what I usually feel about Ebert is his consistency is right on. He is able to put himself in the perspective of other people when he's watching his films and not just say, look, here's who I am, but here's how this could speak to a lot of different people.
Yeah.
And in this, he seemingly just ignores that aspect of himself and says, this does not please me as the singular viewer.
Yeah. But the other thing is, like, that's, so Roger Ebert also famously doesn't have children, although I guess his beloved wife Chaz did. And he was very close to those, but I wonder, like, sometimes, like, I know it's not the first time I've wondered if the, in a bit, like not rocking babies to sleep or not seeing children in the formative, like if that, like, you need that perspective, or absent that, be a child to watch the movie to understand that, like, kids aren't going to react the way you think they're going to react.
Yeah, maybe.
But I don't know. He's articulate on other controversial kids movies. All right, well, let's dismiss the Grumpy Grandpa segment of the film and talk about why. I think it's safe to say we both think this is, like, an awesome film. One of our all-time favorite Christmas films.
And for all of those reasons that we just mentioned. I mean, this came out in 1990. I don't think I saw it in theaters. I think I saw it on TV because this is a Christmas movie, and my parents would, of course, not let me go see that.
What's crazy is my mom, who was probably in the top 3 strictest parents in our congregation, took us kids to see this movie.
That's stupid.
I mean,
just stupid.
What
was she thinking?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's one of those things where I wish I could call her up and be like, what is this inconsistency? Like, you know, I mean, I said on the live watch that my mom would always find a way to justify the things that she wanted to do. Like, she wanted to see JFK really bad. She saw JFK. She wanted to see Schindler. She would see rated R movies or movies that are, like, you know, have unchristian material if she wanted. Like, she is a huge James Bond fan. James Bond is many things. Christian morality,
yeah,
not so much. But she loved that shit. So, like, I don't know. I don't understand. Usually that stuff would favor more adult-oriented things that she'd be interested in. I don't know why she would be half, like, make an excuse to take us to see this. Like, and this movie is, like, Christmas as fuck.
In like, parts, yes.
Everything. Like, the weapons that he uses against the guys are Christmas. Like the fact that, like, this is a Christmas trip. The house is all done up in Christmas. The lights coming on and off is, like, a part of the plot point. Mm-hmm. Like, I saw in some of the trivia that I was researching this morning that, like, Chris Columbus intentionally picked a very red and green heavy palette for, like, costuming and all that stuff just to further reinforce the Christmas nature of the film.
Yeah. I guess there is no caroling.
I guess that's the thing. It's like,
but there's nativity scenes and there's right. all kinds of stuff.
But there wasn't like, you know, like Santa Claus didn't come to save the day. There wasn't like an actual Christmas miracle. There was no actual like asking to believe. I wish I could just call up my mom. Maybe we should do that. Let's get her on Skype. I haven't talked to her in like 10 years.
Yeah.
Hey, I just calling to see what the hell is up with Home Alone. I don't know, but it's...
That's crazy, yeah. I saw it on TV a whole bunch.
I saw it in the movies, and we also went to see it on opening... We went to see Home Alone 2 opening night as a family. So
weird.
It's kooky, but that's a real fact about my upbringing.
But yeah, that's one of the main reasons that I love it so much. And the other reason is I think this is like the perfect story for the kid who wants to booby-trap things.
Mm-hmm.
And has this fantasy about how it will all go. Of course, it will go nothing like this. Your booby traps will fail time and time again, and the people you're trying to prank will not walk into them, and they'll fizzle, and all kinds of things. But
you'll set the front door on fire.
Well, yeah, I didn't get that elaborate. but that's the thing. Like, this is the ultimate fantasy for that kid.
Yeah. It's like it's Goonies. Like, can a guy like Data, can a kid like Data create the jaws of life?
Of course not.
No. Can he try over a summer afternoon to invent something with false teeth that he stole from his grandparents and a slinky? Of course.
And he has.
Of course.
Yeah. That kid before he made that movie had tried this.
Right. And in the movie it just happens that everything works correctly. And that's the thing. Like I think it's brilliant, all the different Rube Goldberg contraptions he builds, because they're just like some of them, the most elaborate one I think is like his simulated party.
Uh-huh.
Like they're like, you know, that really stretches like the bounds of what a kid could get up with like pulleys and cables and levers. Yeah. But like, you know, how can you hate throwing paint cans down on with a string? Like, that's like, yeah, an 8-year-old could absolutely pull that off.
And the most important thing is these guys deserve it, right?
Yes.
Whatever happens to them, they deserve it. They're breaking and entering into a house where they know there's a kid home alone, and they're actively looking to kill him.
Yes.
They want to murder this child.
Yes,
so please step back and say everything is justified here.
These are criminals that are preying on, and not only that, they're flooding people's homes in the winter, which is beyond the fucking pale. You come back from a vacation and your basement's flooded because some asshole has not only stolen everything, including your Christmas tree and your presents, like the goddamn Grinch. Like, you know what? Grinch didn't fucking cause property damage.
Yeah.
Grinch steal your shit, sure. But he's not going to, like, clog up your toilets and flood your sinks until the whole house is just fucking ruined in the dead of winter.
It's true.
Terrible. These guys are terrible people. And they're cartoon characters, so... But that was one of the other things is like I kept seeing like how unrealistic it was, but I don't know. I thought it was super. I thought there was nothing in this movie. I mean, in fact, when I was watching it the first time, I was when we were doing the live watch, I had a kind of a critical eye. Like, the thing I thought that if I was looking at it as a critic, that it would be like, how in the world do they engineer a situation where this kid can be left behind?
Yeah.
When the family, and I'm like, it's still the most wildly implausible thing, but the movie bent over backwards to give reasons why this could happen.
Yeah.
Like, they staged, it was this, like, perfect storm of the cable on the telephone lines going out, and annoying neighbor kid pestering adults with questions.
Interesting teenagers with responsibility.
that they might not be up for, and, like, the power going out, so they overslept, and everything was, like, crazy. Like, I don't know, like... If your suspension of disbelief can't survive the 9 different repulsors that Chris Columbus straps to it in this movie, then I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, and I mean, that's that's the thing. I mean, John Hughes wrote this, and you can see, you can feel the John Hughes in it. Mm-hmm. So many of his movies have things like that, where it's just plausible enough that things might, in some warped reality, go this way. Or in the infinite, he kind of takes like one of he plucks the singular universe in which this goes correctly from the timeline,
right,
and says we're just going to show you this one,
right,
as opposed to the infinite amount where Kevin fails and is murdered,
right,
or where the parents go, oh shit, we left our kid behind before they get on the plane,
right.
So I don't know,
the other thing is like my god, like. Don't you give, like, comedies a little bit of, like, benefit of the doubts?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you have to.
So another criticism I've seen is, like, that it's almost inappropriate for a Christmas film because this family is so dysfunctional and so kind of shitty, the Kevin in the beginning, that, like, but again, that's all to serve. If Kevin is huddling downstairs cold and hungry and crying for the 4 days his parents and family are gone, that's not a great movie to watch. You have to engineer a situation where this kid has enough pre-adolescent angst and anger at his family that when he wakes up and sees they're gone, he's like, good, I'm glad.
Yeah, it's believable. I mean, yeah. His mom sends him to his room, says, I never want to see you
not
again.
Not his room, sends him to that fucking attic.
That's right, he doesn't live up there. He's temporarily being bunked there. Yeah, she sends him up there and says, I never want to see you again.
Which, that's the tenth repulsor that they strapped to the thing. The fact that this kid didn't want to sleep with his cousin, who's also Macaulay Culkin's brother, which is kind of funny. Because he's a bedwetter, so fine, you can sleep up here. And this, and Kevin takes it. And then he wishes
his brothers and sisters all hate him.
But that's the thing, like, in that... His
uncle really hates him. Holy shit.
Right, and I'm predisposed to be anti the baby of the family because I was the oldest, and oh god, my brother and sister got away with criminal levels of bullshit. And sometimes made my life a living hell. But I gotta say, like, I'm totally on Kevin's side here. Like, your older brother, who probably prefers the Supreme Pizza, fucking eats all your cheese pizza.
Yep.
You're getting forced to sleep with the bedwetter. No one wants to hear a goddamn word about your fairness. And that's always, I always hated that as a kid when parents just come in and like try to split things down the middle, because that's not how, like sometimes someone did start shit and they need to be punished. Instead, it's just like, would you guys just fucking get along and stop? Like, well, would you like support justice in this house?
Would you like to mediate this thing?
No justice, please? Like, you start, like, you're gonna have to fucking do like civil disobedience to get these goddamn adults to pay attention to these kid concerns. But like, yeah, like Kevin's getting shit on in the first act of this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is why it's so satisfying to both him and us when his family disappears.
Right.
And he gets the run of the house.
Right, so my point is, like, you have to engineer a pretty dysfunctional family to make Kevin's attitude towards being left alone work in a film.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another calling card, I think, of John Hughes, is you can look at, like, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation or really any of the National Lampoon movies.
Right.
That's a fairly dysfunctional family.
Right.
I mean, Chevy Chase is just a lunatic in that movie. You look at Randy Quaid coming in, he's... you got a complete fuck up.
Right.
There's a lot of dysfunction in that family as well.
There's a lot of...
And Breakfast Club. I mean, all of John Hughes' stuff is like that.
And there's a lot of, like... point, like, what am I trying to think? Like, there's very few degrees of separation between a lot of these movies. Like, Uncle Buck, for example.
Yeah,
and,
which stars Macaulay Culkin.
Macaulay Culkin, that came out the year before. Like, all these movies, like, were things that were, like, written by Chris Columbus and directed by John Hughes and shot... like, there's a lot of, like, incestual mixing into this 1990s Home Alone. But I think it's cool because, like, everybody was comfortable with everybody.
Yeah.
And everybody had a similar sensibility, and they kind of had this kind of, like... you know, anti-family vibe to them. Like, somehow it's like, you know, that was a thing in the 80s and 90s, like the disruption of nuclear family. So, like, you know, even fucked up families can be fun and loving. You know what? I just realized we've almost fucking forgot the most important part of this whole
thing.
Oh,
yeah. We haven't
drank our booze.
That's right. Let's put a pause on Home Alone.
Yeah.
And let's check this out.
Yeah, this is so our dram for today from our whiskey advent calendar. which if you want more information for, there is a thread on the forums, the Mary Culk and Keatmas hub that has a link to what we're drinking and our, at least my comments on the booze. This is I looked up how to pronounce it. Boonahabben.
Yeah.
35-year-old scotch, 40.2% alcohol by volume, relative lightweight.
Piece of cake.
Yeah. And actually, you know what? I was excited because a lot of the scotches have been so high alcohol content that like kind of disrupts from the flavor profile.
I think so, yeah.
So this is the rare 35-year-old scotch that hasn't distilled itself into like 50% alcohol. Let's
give it a shot, I guess. Hmm.
Oh man, I tell you what, it really hit my tongue with like a very mild, almost pear kind of flavor.
Yeah, there's a lot of fruit in that one,
and it's turning into like a nice like that burnt brown sugar I keep talking about, that like kind of like sweetish aftertaste. And it's mild and smooth.
Yeah, which makes it one of my favorites so far.
Yeah, I'm saying this is probably top three, certainly top four.
Boonahabben, 35-year-old.
Yeah, so I'm liking that. All right, so we'll be sipping that throughout the rest of the podcast. Man, I forget where I was going with all this. Like, oh, there's the fact that, like, you know, that's a criticism that, like, you know, this family's not perfect, and that's kind of like the engine that requires the film to go on. And even I have a quibble, because at the end, the way they directed Macaulay Culkin when he first sees his mom, like, he plays a little hard to get emotionally, which I think is probably the better artistic choice. But like, this film, I felt like maybe it would have been better if they'd have been a little sentimental. Like, that is an 8-year-old who's been through a lot of trauma, who was wishing his parents would come back, and they have in fact come back. And
really, he only loves his mom is the thing, because he and his mom do get sentimental.
Yeah.
And especially if you watch number two.
Yeah.
When it happens again.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert: they made a Home Alone 2, and it's the same premise.
Mm-hmm.
They get really sentimental in that one.
Okay.
Like when Kevin and his mom are reunited.
Weekend?
No.
Oh.
I just remember. For some reason, I remember Home Alone 2 really well, and I hardly remembered anything of this movie.
That's weird.
Seen Home Alone 2 more recently, though.
Huh. I've seen them both in the last year, and it is easy to get them confused, but I guess when I look back and I think of, like, it's like a color palette, because all of the – because he essentially stages this in, like, an abandoned in New York, it's an abandoned kind of, like, brownstone.
I want to say it's the same uncle's house. It's the uncle who yells at him.
Really?
Yeah, it's his house in New York.
Yeah.
But I'm not totally sure it's the same uncle. I know it's an uncle.
But I feel like this movie would be a little, like, I think it would be just perfect for me. It would be sweetened to my taste, if Kevin had been a little bit more, you know, warm and embracing his mother instead of being kind of standoffish and abrasive. But again, that makes sense in light of, I guess, the setup of the movie and all that. Like, they did such a good job of setting up the family dysfunction that it would preclude that kind of treacly sentiment, I guess.
Yeah. The other thing I like is, you know, the surprise of the rest of the family arriving home.
Right.
Because it shows that they don't all absolutely hate him. They just had other concerns going, and their head was on fire, essentially, while they were all getting ready.
It is funny how few shits Kevin's dad gives about the situation, though.
When, like, during the course of his mom panicking and trying to get a hold of the cops and stuff?
Yeah, the whole time.
The, like, flight out when he's talking about, what'd you leave behind? Oh, I don't know. I left my, what does he say?
The garage door open.
The garage door
Which,
open.
By the way, giant fuck up. You're gonna leave town and leave your garage doors open.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, like... But he's, like, the whole time, like, he just, I don't know, there's a detached quality. Like Joe Pesci as a police officer is there, and he finally gets a hold of Kevin's dad, and Kevin's dad's like, oh, okay, well, yeah, we got our lights on a timer. pizza's here, see ya, and just leave. Like who turns their back on a cop standing in their entryway and just like pieces out? And then the whole time he's like, yeah, you know, we'll get back to Kevin as fast as we can. Like, it's the mom that goes and like hounds the airport lady and pawns her earrings and all that stuff, and dad is like, I mean, I get it, because the rest of the, this is such a, can you imagine what a big bummer this is for the rest of the family?
That like, oh yeah, we're going to Paris.
Right, and the adults are flying first class, and the kids are back in coach, and we're taking the whole family, we're going to do this magical Paris, and now you can't enjoy it because Kevin is gone and done his Kevin thing.
Really, the person to blame is the oldest sister, cousin, I don't know what she is.
I think it's the oldest daughter.
Yeah, the teenage daughter who did the head count. She's to blame.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Her fault.
But it's an understandable mistake.
It is, yeah.
One blonde kid in a hat looks the same as every other blonde kid in a hat from behind.
For sure.
But it's amusing how Kevin's dad just seemed to always want to take like the emotional off-ramp.
Yeah.
Like, I get it. Kevin's in danger, but you know, we've called the cops and we've got the earliest ticket back. Let's, you know, maybe go get in a baguette. Maybe get a baguette.
Come on, we're in Paris. We came all this way. Let's get a baguette.
They turned the Eiffel Tower into the world's tallest Christmas tree. Can we go? I don't even think that's true. It's probably insulting.
No, I have no idea what.
I mean, if it was my Eiffel Tower, I'd turn it into the world's largest Christmas tree.
I'd need a really big ladder, but I'd try.
But I'm not a Frenchman.
Well, it makes me wonder what he does for a living, because he seems to be sort of aloof. And yet he is stunningly rich. I mean, the house that they live in is a mansion if you were to stick it in the outskirts of Cincinnati.
It recently sold for $1.5 million.
Oh, that seems low.
Back in it sold in 2011 at kind of the low point of the real estate.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The bubble.
I was going to say, if you told me $3 million,
asking for 2.8, I think, which is of what I thought. But you were right. It is in the North Shore, like, suburbs of Chicago, and it's like Old Man Murray's house. Is that his name, Old Man Murray?
That's what I called him during the live watch. I
think
no idea.
It is, and that's like, did Chet and Chet or Erica take their website name from that?
I don't know. I'll look it up while you're...
But his house did sell for almost $3 million.
Holy shit.
So, like, yeah, this is a well-to-do family. Again, they... this guy flew all the adults first class.
Mm-hmm.
He like dropped 40 grand on this Paris trip.
Oh, easily. Yeah.
And again, the house is also, it's Christmas as fuck, but it's also 90s as fuck. Like, it's super amusing to see all this god awful wallpaper everywhere.
Yeah.
It's so much like bare wood trim, like just like natural wood, like cabinetry, like all the shit that like everyone's desperately trying to rip out of their kitchens, and
all the shit I want to get out of my
now.
House.
Exactly. Yeah. That's like that was like state of the art, super chic. Like, oh, why do we even decorate our homes?
Yeah, if it goes out of style in 10,
it's like,
20
why
years.
Do we clothe our bodies like this? I don't understand style
for
and
warmth,
fashion.
For warmth, hey, but the house thing I don't understand.
Yeah, like, why can't we agree on like, I don't know, a couple of different looks. Like, this is a casual. Can we all agree that this is casual, this is formal, this is business, and we can just wear that shit? Like, can't we all, like can we join Starfleet and just wear velour pajamas all day? And that's like...
I feel like that would really limit the loot box potential in Overwatch. So, no, I'm sorry, we can't.
Well, the loot box potential is going away when they start regulating that, like, the gambling industry that it is.
Sure.
But yeah, no, fair point.
But yeah, the house is amazing aside from the wallpaper.
Yeah.
It is a truly gigantic house, detached two-car garage. Kind of surprised it's detached.
Got a greenhouse in the backyard, I read.
Greenhouse?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Huh. Okay.
And they actually built that.
What's Mr. McAllister growing back there?
That's the thing. He's got that green gold.
I bet he
does.
He got
in early. He has been planning for legalization since the late 80s.
That explains the laid-back attitude and the money.
He's playing the long, long game. But no, it's like if you do any research into the house, there was a bunch of articles written when it got sold. And there's a lot of, like, it looks incredible now. Like, it's all done super modern. It's like the kitchen's all white and stainless steel. And they ripped out that ghastly tile countertop and replaced it with, you know, probably marble or whatever. And it looks.
The guy's name is Old Man Marley.
Marley.
Yeah.
Well, it should have been Murray.
Should have.
That's okay. So, what do you think about that part of the that part of the plot?
The subplot of the old man.
Yeah.
Who, I guess to explain it for people who haven't watched this.
No, fuck
recently.
That. Everyone's watched it, and they haven't. You should.
Basically, he's the scary old man next door who Buzz makes up stories about,
mm-hmm.
or actually doesn't. Buzz doesn't make that up. Somebody along the way made it up, and it has been spreading this rumor that he killed a bunch of people.
Right.
Potentially with a snow shovel.
Yeah.
I guess he's aware of that mythos, that fiction that has been spun around him.
Because that's the thing. It's like, I could see if his was the one house that was like run down and had his shutters all crooked and the roof is leaky and he hadn't mowed his, but he's like, you know, he's very meticulous. Like, I remember I was talking during the live watch, like the fact that, You, I think both of our mental images that this guy was like kind of like shabby and wild eyed and like kind of crazy. But like even from the very beginning of the film, he's got a very nice coat. He's got his hair is always like, you know, done just so. And his beard's nicely groomed. Like,
yeah,
in the dark, I guess you could pass for a crazy like, you know, axe murdering dude. But like it doesn't really hold up to that scrutiny. Like why in a neighborhood like this would this guy get this? I wish they'd left it just as this is something Buzz was doing the fuck with Kevin.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like they should have. It would have sold the Kevin hates his family arc a little bit more, too.
Right, right. But I think it's almost vital because that was the bridge to get Kevin thinking about his family and how reconciling with your family is important. And mm-hmm. But, you know, it's like it's always easier to pick out the splinter from someone else's eye than picking out of your own. But that was an important step of you know, Kevin make that corner in his character. Plus, I also think it's a nice little bit of realism that the 8-year-old couldn't vanquish the robbers all by himself. He made a good show of it, but at the end, you needed some dude with a shovel to come in and dispense some justice to Joe Pesci's pate. And I like that too.
Yeah, this is something they do in both this movie and Home Alone 2.
Right.
You remember that crazy old homeless pigeon lady?
Yeah. Right.
They essentially make her the exact same character.
Right. She comes and scary does a Care Bear scare with the pigeons at the end.
Yeah, and then she has the sad backstory with her family and everything. And, you know, it's all a way to teach Kevin about his own family.
Yeah. I saw some behind-the-scenes background that, like, Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern both thought this movie is going to be a giant piece of shit. So they were, like, kind of checked out and extremely hammy in their performances. Which I actually think it served to make the movie better. And the other thing is, like, I guess Joe Pesci, you know, because this is like Goodfellas era.
This
Pesci.
Is like the same year as Goodfellas.
I guess it was a real struggle for him not to get like just throw fuck this, fuck that around in his like improvised like language, and they had to like overdub and redub some of that, and like Chris Columbus was trying to get him to say fridge instead of fuck, and there is Daniel Stern actually says it has an audible like shit as he's trying to struggle in through the dog door, I think.
Huh, okay.
It was like one of the ones that snuck into the film. But I thought that was kind of surprising that not only that, but like so many actors had passed on this. Like their first choice for Marv was Robert De Niro.
Ooh, okay.
Then they tried to get Bob Hoskins. And then finally Joe Pesci said he would do it, but he was going to like phone it in and give like a shitty performance.
He told them that?
No, I mean,
I'm not really going to work here.
That's what they both said in interviews, that they were just kind of like, even on set, were like, you know, this is like such a shit. This is going to be so stupid.
And the truly hilarious thing is that Daniel Stern basically went on to do this for the rest of his career.
Pretty much, yeah. He's famous for, I mean, he was a big deal at this era. Like, he had these giant, yeah, like, fuck that. What's that Billy Crystal, Dude Ranch? Shit.
Oh,
City Slickers.
Yeah.
He's in City Slickers. He narrated The Wonder Years. And he did this, and that's about it.
He narrated The Wonder Years?
Wasn't that true? Yeah.
I have no idea, but.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
It certainly could be.
But I thought that was an interesting factoid, the fact that none of these people really believed in the film.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of stuff with him in it since then that has been terrible. I mean, Bushwhacked is essentially this movie.
Yeah.
For Daniel Stern's part, anyway.
Huh. I've not seen Bushwhacked.
I wouldn't recommend it. It's not great.
What else? I mean,
The hidden mystery of this movie, before we leave Old Man Marley, is how he got that cut on his hand.
The Old Man Murray stigmata.
Right, because it clearly goes all the way through his hand.
The passion of the old man.
I think maybe he tried to wander in to help Kevin out and got caught in a booby trap. Got a nail through the hand or something.
I think you're supposed to understand. I think the only reason he's got it is so he could be at the drugstore at the same time Kevin was.
Right. I want to know what happened to him.
Didn't he say he cut his hand shoveling?
How do you cut your hand shoveling?
That's a sharp-ass metal blade he's using.
He grabbed the shovel into the shovel?
Yeah. Yeah, and it kind of just slipped on him, or maybe he was down, like he got a grip down low and his hand shifted forward and there's like a rivet or something he caught it on. Mm. But I thought he said that he cut it shoveling.
I don't know, it was a live watch.
Because he's eternally shoveling snow in this movie.
He is, yeah. But it's Chicago, so that's believable.
I guess that's true. How much snowfall does Chicago get?
I mean, more than here.
Like a couple feet?
We had a very mild winter when I was there, so it wasn't bad. Yeah.
Because I've been in Chicago a couple times during the winter, and they essentially bulldoze all their snow onto Lake Michigan.
Yeah,
and you get impressive mountains of snow.
And I've had snow delays in Chicago more than anywhere else.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
As far as flights go.
Yeah.
What's your favorite booby trap? We haven't really talked about the booby trap stuff yet. Wait. Before we do that, we've been talking about John Hughes and Chris Columbus.
Yes.
And John Williams scored this thing. I want to say this is maybe the least memorable John Williams score I can think of.
Hmm.
Which is not to say the least memorable he's ever done, because I wouldn't be able to think of those either. But now that you bring up that this is John Williams, I don't remember any of the score for this.
I mean, I could probably hum the main da 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 da. It's certainly no Raiders March or Superman main theme it's more along the lines of his Harry Potter score, although that's pretty evocative. You could probably hum the first few bars of Harry Potter's theme.
Not me.
Seriously? No.
I saw half of one movie.
How the fuck could you? Okay, well, that's your pop culture blind spot.
Yeah, for sure.
It's sort of
forgettable, I'll say.
The other thing is, I guess the first composer pulled. There's another thing. A first composer pulled out of that.
John Williams is not your first choice.
He is not your first, because in fact, Chris Columbus,
I feel like he should get every. He should get literally every first offer.
So here's the thing:
Hollywood.
Their budget for this film was pretty shoestring.
It shouldn't matter. Just John Williams. Will you do it for $80? No. Okay. Bring in number two.
But they were afraid that John Williams wouldn't do it for the cost that they could give it. So what they did is they did a rough cut of the movie and they got it together and they sent it off to John Williams. And John Williams watched it. He's like, fuck yeah, I want to score this movie. Because John Williams is not a fucking heartless child hater Roger Ebert.
Right.
He saw the charm in it. But I guess that's fair, because if I can't think of more than two bars of the film score, then
yeah,
it's pretty forgettable.
It's just not that memorable. And I'm not saying it's not good. Mm-hmm. It's just not that memorable. Who do you think is more influential in that era, John Williams or John Hughes?
Oh, John Williams. John Williams has ruled, three decades of film scoring?
When you think of...
He's only really fallen off of recent times, because he's old and he's getting ready to retire / die.
I will say that John Hughes kind of defines what I think of as the typical teen 80s movie.
Sure.
Just period. He is the guy. But John Williams more so has dominated an entire genre of the industry.
Right.
This is film scoring and this is John Williams and they are synonymous. And I don't think... I will say, look, I wasn't a teenager in the 80s.
Yeah.
So I didn't identify as strongly with stuff like 16 Candles or mm-hmm. a lot of his early stuff. But mm-hmm. I think John Williams takes it for me.
He's
developed the most iconic themes in cinematic history.
Agreed.
And he's done it consistently over the last... I mean, Jurassic Park was in 1993, 95, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He's done it for two decades up to that point, and he's still doing it.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. Like, he was scored. Like, Star Wars is in the 70s. Star Wars was also in the 80s. Jaws was in the 70s. Yep. You know, the Indiana Jones stuff, Close Encounters. Like, I'm struggling to do, like, his 90s repertoire, but...
Jurassic Park.
Yeah, Jurassic
like,
Park.
Like, is a huge one. That's one of the most memorable themes ever.
And in the aughts, he did, like, he did all the Harry Potters and... Yeah, so he's in the Star Wars prequels, so he's... it's funny because it is a particular sensibility, right? Like, this, like, almost a classic, like, big operatic score. Like, I don't know why that stuff is ascendant over, like, stuff that Trent Reznor, like, Dave Porter does, like, the more...
Yeah.
Industrial. Dave Porter's incapable of doing, like, non-synthetic, weirdo stuff, but...
Sure.
It is... when I think of movie soundtracks, I think of like crashing cymbals and brassy trumpets and, you know, deep bass notes. But that's the other thing is like, honestly, a big part of the score is the licensed music, you know, the Christmas music. There's a lot of old favorites in there.
Yeah, that's true.
Did you know that the Angels with Dirty Faces or whatever the fuck, did you know that that is a film that they actually filmed for Home Alone? It's not a real gangster film from the 30s?
Yeah, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that until like I literally started researching this movie, that they filmed that specifically, and then they filmed the fake sequel for Home Alone 2.
Okay.
Which I don't even remember how that features in there, right?
No.
Like, I remember, like, I just saw Home Alone 2... like 2 or 3 years ago, or no, like 2 years ago, and I remember like the Donald Trump cameo, but I don't, and I remember Tim, what's his name?
Curry.
Yeah, Tim Curry. Yep. I don't, Rob Schneider, apparently, has got
a big...
Yeah,
he's the bellhop,
I totally forgot about that.
I think he's the bellhop?
I can't think of his role in the movie.
The bellhop, Tim Curry is the bellhop. I think Rob Schneider is the guy at the desk in the hotel.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you. Yeah, he's the concierge that can hook you up with weed when you're in a hotel.
Yeah.
That sounds like it.
Yeah, it's amazing. I like that movie as much as I do with him in it.
But the other thing that I really like about this movie is like it's such an efficient three-act structure. The first act is the setup, showing how this can happen. Act two is essentially every kid's fantasy of what you would do. Like, the fact that, like, I can be an adult. I can take care of myself. I can wash all my crevices, and I can put myself to bed in time, and I can...
Yeah.
I can...
Him becoming, like, the man of the house, right?
Yeah. Like, not falling completely on your face. And the third act is the slapstick caper and everything. And the way...
The second act is essentially trying to prove your family wrong about you.
Right.
Basically.
Right. And, like, the fact that the Wet Bandits are kind of, like... they tie all three acts together because you first have, you got Marv posing as a police officer, mm-hmm. and then you have like their other capers. You see them like robbing other houses, and you see them like casing a joint, and like, you know, Kevin is able to foil them a few times just with like subterfuge and tricks, mm-hmm. but that just sets up the final confrontation where, you know, he's got to defend his house against these bad guys. And it's a great way to tell the story.
Yeah. It's efficient. So which one? Let's talk about the booby traps, because the booby traps are obviously the highlight of this movie.
Yeah.
And I thought that I had remembered there being other booby traps in this movie.
Uh-huh.
Apparently there are not. The on the stairs, the paint cans are it, right?
Yeah.
There's no big pole that he drops on.
That's
him, or like a banister.
That's three or two. I think he drops the like cast iron pipe that takes them both out.
And they don't fall for the paint buckets. Mm-hmm. They're able to dodge those, and then they get the pipe. But several of these booby traps are just purely devastating. Like, mm-hmm. like probably kill you levels of devastating.
Mm-hmm.
But not on the level of Home Alone 2. Home Alone 2, they really had to ratchet it up.
I don't think there's anything more brutal than the bricks being thrown fatality.
Yeah, Home Alone 2, Marv gets hit in the head with like six bricks from four stories up.
Yeah.
It's brutal.
Yeah. But it's funny. It is
hilarious.
So goddamn funny. I'm trying to think in this movie, what's the, my favorite slash the most brutal? I think the most brutal is the 6-inch nail. Yeah.
Yep.
Because it's like a slow motion, just like it's kind of it's pretty fucking brutal. It's pretty savage.
It's one of those things where you look at it, like Daniel Stern looks down at his foot. Marv's looking at his foot.
Yeah.
He sees the nail.
Yeah.
He sees himself stepping on the nail. He sees the nail going in and through his foot.
Yeah.
And by the time he has realized this is going to hurt, it's already far too late.
Yeah.
He's already completed the action, and it's so horrifying.
A lot of foot trauma. Like, John McClane got off easy.
Oh, he did. Yeah, the ornaments, we didn't talk.
Yeah, like the ornaments. So, like, so you've got the... You got the hot door handle.
Right, classic.
Which I found out what that device is. It's an electric charcoal starter. Apparently, you put that in underneath your grill, you stack your charcoal on top of it, and that thing gets red hot, and it ignites it, and you don't have to use, like, lighter fluid or whatever.
Makes sense with that big boiler in the basement that they'd have that.
Yeah, but I'm like, what the fuck is... So they got that. They got the Micro Machines, which I liked, because it made me remember Micro Machines, which I think are just a cooler version of Matchbox or Hot Wheels.
Yep.
You've got the paint cans.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the where does the spider? Because the spider is just guerrilla warfare. Like, that's just like the spider got out sometime in Act Two, and Kevin is able to I don't like spiders, so watching Kevin grab that thing's big, disgusting, bloated body, and it's obviously a real spider, and I think it's actually Macaulay Culkin grabbing it, and then I can't imagine having a tarantula like over my eye socket. Like, that is just, like, I think I might die just from the idea of that fucking monster being on my face. It might kill me. I have an irrational fear of especially large, dangerous, hairy spiders like that.
That one, I think, is pretty rational.
Not that they're dangerous. Like, you know, even if a tarantula bit you, it's supposedly not even as bad as getting stung by a hornet. But still.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't like that scene.
There's something like very primitive and malevolent about a spider that I just don't like. Mm-hmm. I don't like. Like, you can love a spider all you want, it ain't gonna love you back.
Nope.
If it could, it would spin you up in a web and suck your insides out, and that's a fact. That's a fucking fact.
Just watch Arachnophobia. You'll see.
Right, right. Like, I am under no illusion that my cat would eat my face off within 6 hours of my death, but it will wait for me to die. It will not stalk me, spin me into a web, paralyze me, and suck my fluids out alive. It will do me the courtesy of allowing me to die first and be like, hey, you'll probably tap my face for a couple hours. Are you using this nose? No, I'm going to start eating it. Like, I get that. That's the one that I had to, like, if you see me on the live watch, that was me at my most uncomfortable watching.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, I think the other great thing about that nail thing is how he gets the socks and shoes off of Marv.
That's the thing that's so great about it. It's a premeditated thing.
Yeah.
Like, you got the tar leading up, and then make sure all your socks are off, all your shoes are off. Like, you're softening them up for the foot trauma to come.
Yep.
Although my favorite is the iced stairs.
Oh, God.
I think, like, watching...
That's the first one, right? Like, they go down toward the basement and...
Yeah, there's, like... And they both get it. Like, Joe Pesci's got the front door. Daniel's got the back. And they both, like, pratfall on these ice-cold cement stairs. And it's merciless and pitiless. And as a newly minted old man at 41, I just, like, those things are fucking brutal, man.
They are.
Like, slipping and falling repeatedly like that, and I felt like...
The comedic performance from Daniel Stern there is great.
That's amazing.
Like, slipping and sliding and trying to get his footing, and then he, like, spreads his legs to the walls.
Yes.
Perfect. Perfect comedic.
Yeah, like, for guys that are phoning it in and thinking this is bullshit, like, I felt like they did a remarkably good job, because both of those, they really sell the physical... anybody can kick a guy in the balls. Mm-hmm. But it does take a little bit of showmanship to sell that. Like, the guys in the Goonies, like, you know, slip and they fall in the tree trunk. Like, that's funny, not because their balls got hurt, but because they sold the fact that their balls got hurt.
Sure. No reaction is not funny.
Ouch, my balls.
I can't remember. Does the tool kit open in this one?
I don't
and
think
rain
so.
Wrenches down? Is that number two?
We also had what happened in this one was the red hot iron coming down the clothes chute. Which that's like my
Oh, to hit Daniel Stern, yeah.
Yeah, like, that's, I don't know if that's a thing anymore, but, like, in both, in the house I grew up in, and then the second house I bought, there was, like, this chute from the second floor down to the bottom floor where you could drop clothes through.
Yeah.
And, yeah, like, dropping shit through that was, like, an endlessly fascinating thing to do. My mom fucking hated it. Like,
of course, yeah.
Stop throwing your G.I. Joes down this, you know, and, like, well, it's, like, I'm sorry if you don't want me throwing stuff down this cool hole that we just have in the middle of the house, and don't put a cool hole in the middle of the house, lady.
Yep.
What do you want? But yeah, I thought that's the brick of this movie. Like, getting hit in the forehead with a red hot iron.
There's the blowtorch that takes blowtorch off the top of Joe Pesci's Harry's head. Yep.
Joe Pesci's Harry? I thought he was Marv.
No, he's
Daniel's Marv.
Yeah.
Ah. Okay, I've been calling, so just go back and reverse the
I
Marv
had that
and
problem,
areas.
Too. I definitely thought that Joe Pesci was Marv in this, but I guess he's not.
Yeah. Can we talk about Macaulay Culkin? Because, like,
sure.
I was, you know, this is, like, one of, like, considered one of the all-time classic child performances, and, like, he's also this kind of, like, weird cautionary tale in Hollywood of a little boy who gets super famous ahead of his time, and then he falls into the wrong crowd with Michael Jackson, and you know, he kind of, like, hits the skids in his teenage years. And I mean last I saw him, he did this kind of funny thing in 2015 where he played, like, an amalgamation of all his characters, because apparently this Macaulay Culkin got married to Anna Schlumsky, because he refers to that, and he's a cab driver, and he looks like he's on all the drugs, and he ends up, like, torturing some guy to death at the end. But it's pretty funny and self-aware.
Yeah.
It's weird that his brother has had a more successful adult film career than he has.
Yeah, he did Scott Pilgrim. Mm-hmm. Shit, what's that?
Was he not in Fargo?
He was
in season 2 of Fargo.
Yeah,
I thought he was pretty good as, like, the ne'er-do-well younger brother of Bear and what's his face?
Shit, I can't remember the other
it
thing.
It doesn't. That's
in,
like, but... two. That's like 3 years ago. I can't remember.
Yeah, he's been in several things over the years.
But I was primed to be like, yeah, everyone says it, but he's not all that. But I just, like, he's just really fucking good. First of all, he's a beautiful child. Like,
in the live watch, you described him rather disturbingly as, like, the perfect Aryan,
like the Nazi poster boy.
Yeah,
he does. He has crystal clear blue eyes, and they're enormous. He has, like fucking almost bleached toe head white. And, like, his skin is perfect. Like, even when he gets, like, red pat, like you know, chapped out in the wind, like, it's still, like, he's got flawless fucking skin tone.
His pores don't work. That's the downside. He sweats everywhere except his face.
They did some kind of weird chemical peel when he was 5 where he just doesn't have pores.
Right.
Yeah, he's like carved out of fucking marble, this child. And he also, like,
abs of steel.
he also carries a lot of, like it's funny, like, what a little man he is. Like, when he's dealing with the woman at the store, he's got this kind of, like, pitter patter, and with, like, yo, oh yeah, this is for the kids, you know. And I think he's, like, really, he's really incredible.
He is. He's really good.
And also, he, like, I'm trying to think, like, one of the first adult crime movies I ever saw was My Girl with the aforementioned Anna Schlumsky and Macaulay Culkin, and he was, like, really fucking good in that. Because, like, you know, like, I'd cried in movies like Dumbo and Bambi and Old Yeller, but, like, you know, an actual, like, I'm like, emotionally connecting with the pain and bullshit of what's going on in here, like, that's it's My Girl. And he's really good, and did he, like, I don't know his story. Did he, like, go fucking crazy and decided he didn't want to act anymore? Or he had all the, did he have, like, tons of money from the acting he'd already done? Because Home Alone, on a $60 million budget, made, like, $500 million.
Yeah.
It's crazy run. I think it's still the highest grossing comedy of all time.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know his story either.
Because most other high grossing comedies are also rated R, which kind of limits their, like, this is, like, you know, family friendly, capital F. Both on both of those.
Yeah, I really don't know what his deal was, and why he isn't a bigger player in Hollywood today.
Maybe he secretly pulls all the strings. He's the overlord of Hollywood.
He's got like Harvey Weinstein on attached to a bunch of ropes, and he's dancing around.
I say maybe that's why Weinstein and Singer are finally getting what's coming to them. That Muck is a new sheriff in town.
Could
he's
be.
Not, he's not. He's not having it. What else we want to? What else we want to talk about?
I want to talk about Marv's desire. Why do you think Marv does what he does?
So Marv is clearly the dumb one. He's clearly, not the brain. Yeah. Harry is the brains of the operation.
Yep.
So I think Marv is dumb, and he also wants to put his own stamp on it.
Yeah.
And he like Harry's smart enough to know the best criminals, the ones you never hear from, and they don't have
right.
And the ones that get away, like Marv wants to be kind of infamous.
Yeah, he wants to be like the Jesse James, right? He
right.
wants to be the bandit that everyone knows. And it's clear
right.
by his actions. He's leaving this wet bandit calling card
right.
of flooding people's houses. When he gets arrested, he tells the cops, "We're the wet bandits.
Yes.
Make sure you put that in the papers."
Yeah, so, oh, yeah, we want to know what those are 9 burglaries that we can put on. Also, it's like,
right.
they came very close to being known as the child murdering bandits.
They did.
And we talked
close.
About that in the live watch. Like, you can say wet bandit all you want, but you kill Macaulay Culkin and you're just going to yep. be the child murdering bandits.
For sure. But yeah, he's clearly in it for the fame.
Yeah.
Which to me makes Harry the dumb one, because Harry should see it. And Harry should know, and Harry shouldn't work with him.
I wonder what their relationship was. Like, when did they meet? How long have they been operating?
Yeah.
Was this like, have they been working their way up to this? Did they like rob? Did they do a stint in the clink for robbing banks, and they decided like, oh, what you really need to do is rob rich people during Christmas?
Yeah, or maybe they got out of the child murder game. It just wasn't lucrative enough.
Right, right. You know, there's just no money in killing kids.
Yeah,
we should rob them of their toys.
Maybe they take turns. Maybe Marv does a child murder job and spearheads that. And then Harry spearheads they trade off. He spearheads the robberies.
You know, speaking of petty crime,
yeah.
My memory of this film, even though I've seen it 2 years ago, was that Kevin essentially stole the pizza.
Okay.
He uses the soundtrack to intimidate the pizza delivery boy into leaving the pizza. But it turns out he steals money from his older brother.
Uh-huh.
And uses that to pay for it. So, like,
but also terrorizes the pizza guy.
Yeah, and like, he's kind of like a why don't you just answer the door as a kid?
Yeah, I don't know.
Doesn't even need it, because like it already established the fact that the movie's there. It's hilariously mm-hmm. used later on to frighten Marv off.
Yeah.
Like, why terrorize the pizza boy?
I'm not sure. I maybe because they thought it was funny.
Like I guess that maybe the thing is that Kevin thinks that if he answers the door, the pizza guy like, "You're a kid, I can't give you pizza. Where's your parents?" But like, I'm telling you, send an 8-year-old to the door with a 20.
Yeah.
The pizza man will happily take it and not think a thing of it.
No, he will not care.
Yeah.
I actually misremembered one of the key things in the movie, which is the hands on the face scene, the scream in Home Alone.
Yeah.
I thought it happened because of some other reason that was relevant to the plot of the movie.
Uh-huh.
It apparently just happens because he uses his dad's aftershave on his face, which must imply that he is shaved, right? I mean, I don't think aftershave burns if you don't have freshly opened hair holes on your face.
I don't even think it would burn if a little kid shaved, because a little kid is like not even...
There's no hair follicles there to open up.
Right.
You're not going to get into the skin that way.
No. Yeah, that's a common misconception. Like if you just throw aftershave on your arm,
it's not acid.
Yeah. No, it's not. It's just alcohol. So unless you've got like a micro abrasions from actually shaving, then maybe that's this thing. It's like we just didn't see him actually shaving.
Yeah. But I fundamentally misremembered. I thought it was because like he saw the crooks coming,
he
realized his parents weren't home.
He does Macaulay Culkin scream a lot in this movie.
Yeah, he does it twice too. I misremembered that as well. I thought it was only once.
Yeah. The other thing is, I feel like they cranked. And I don't know this. Maybe we'll get to this in a Christmas from the future, the ghost of Christmas. Keaton Christmas's future. I don't know. But I feel like in the second one, since that was such a big popular part of the movie, they really amped up the screaming.
Oh, did they?
I feel like
I don't remember that part.
He shaved seven times. He like anything that, like, you know, he sees Tim Curry for the first time, screams. Donald Trump, scream. Rob Schneider, scream.
Yeah.
Pigeon Lady, sure. Scream. Yeah.
He should somehow shave the burglars and dump aftershave all over him. Like shave them head to toe and then dump it on him.
It is kind of funny the aftershave that like that's one piece of pain that he himself felt. Like, how did they not use aftershave or something?
I don't know.
There should have been an elaborate, like, automatic straight razor that, like, then sprayed aftershave on him.
Yeah, and he thinks he's avoided the true catastrophe of being cut up by a razor, right?
Uh-huh.
And then here comes the aftershave.
Oh, that's what happens when after Joe Pesci burns his head, and he puts it out in the snow. As he walks back in, aftershave just spritzes his head.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's some screaming right there.
Real missed opportunity.
Yep. Yep. I don't know. There's like a, I just, Joe, like, what about the other thing? Like, when he gets off to his, you know, his Kevin house, his little tree house, he does that rope thing. And like the two bandits come, like, what, in what world did they think that was a good idea? And what world does following the kid across on the rope become a preferable alternative to going downstairs and going to the tree house? Maybe leave Marv upstairs to keep an eye on the kid. Mm-hmm. We send, like, I don't know. I feel like if they used all their adult wisdom and strength and speed, they probably this would have been a child murder of the movie.
It would have been an actual
horror show. Maybe Ebert would have liked it better because it's more realistic.
Yeah, you can't do that.
No, I don't think you can.
I was a little intimidated by this podcast because as I remembered it, this movie was 90% booby traps and just the same joke over and over again. Essentially, like a two-hour version of Ow, My Balls.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out to be a lot more than that. Like, right. I remembered mostly booby traps, and then I got in the movie and we realized, oh, we're an hour in, and there have been no real booby traps yet.
Right.
And it seems to all take place in the last act.
I do like, there's a couple of capers that I still like. Like, I really like the fake party he puts on.
Yeah.
Like, you see it from the outside, and it's like, it's really well done. Then the inside, there's, because when they sit Kevin to the attic, there's like inexplicably a dozen mannequins up there. Mm-hmm. So he's drug all those out, and he's got them wired, and he's doing this little rocking around the Christmas tree jig, which is making them move. He's also got a Michael Jordan cut out on a train track, and like, I don't know. I think at that, and he's got a mannequin on a turntable, so it's kind of like doing a slow pirouette. And I really like that. I think that might be my favorite gag in the whole film.
Yeah, it's good.
Because you see it from the outside and how it looks, and then you see it from the inside, and it's just like really well staged. And it's probably the most elaborate of the things he does.
Yeah, easily.
But my other question is, did Macaulay Culkin's, how long was he doing the rocking around a Christmas tree dance? Because he doesn't know when the wet bandits are going to pull up.
It's true.
He doesn't know when they're gonna be looking at the house. He's just got to, like, yeah, from like the time, right about the time the lights turn off till like, I don't know, 3 o'clock in the morning, the poor kid is just, you know, it's like
dance till he falls asleep.
Exactly. If they included that brutal detail, maybe again Roger Ebert would have liked it more because it'd be more realistic.
So. Yep.
I don't know. It's cute watching him eat ice cream and watching movies he's not supposed to watch. And
yep.
What else is? I think
the one gag that we did not talk about.
Okay.
Is the BB gun to the nuts? Which
oh right.
Pretty good as like a first volley.
Yeah.
Not a ton to say about it, but painful, I'm sure.
Did you remember John Candy's cameo in here?
No, I didn't.
That's the other thing I want to talk about, how like big John Candy was, like physically, you know, figuratively and literally, and how he like died at the age of 43. I think I looked it up. I'm only 41.
Yeah.
And maybe I should take better care of myself. And maybe you should invest in a life insurance policy on me like I've been trying to get you to do for a couple years.
Yeah, we talked about this during the live
Yeah,
watch?
It's all fun and games till John Candy dies and you start looking at your co-host. He's like, does he more closely resemble, I don't know, John Candy or Chris Farley? Or does he look more like, I don't know, one of those guys that lives till they're 90? But so that's the other thing is like, Is John Candy in this movie just because John Hughes really liked working with him and Uncle Buck?
It's got to be. I can't imagine why. Because he's not a big role.
No, and I guess every bit of his lines was ad-libbed, which that's fine. That's okay. And he did a good job, and I think John Candy is a very lovable galoot, and he's fun to watch. But like, it was weird that there wasn't a lot for him to do.
No.
And the thing is, like, I find that anytime they cut away from Kevin was a little tedious for me.
A little bit, but I think it was necessary. Because if you don't know that his parents are trying to get back to him, I feel like you lose the punch of the final act, whatever it has, you know,
but
reuniting.
I do agree with that, but I felt like giving the mother her own kind of caper. Like where she's scamming an old lady out of her seats with earrings, and she's trapped with John Candy's polka band in the back of a budget rent-a-truck. Like that's the stuff where I'm like, I want a quick 30-second scene where she's stuck at the airport trying to get tickets, and she's making incremental progress back, and oh my god, I'm in Buffalo now, I'm in but I didn't need to see the shtick.
No, and I feel like whatever sentiment they had built up about like people helping people, right? Mm-hmm. And the holiday spirit and coming together to accomplish this impossible task of getting her back to Kevin was totally undermined by the rest of the family walking in no more than 30 seconds after she did by just sitting on their asses and waiting for the next flight.
Right, right, right.
So they totally undermine everything that John Candy and this old lady do to help her.
I mean, it's ironic, but it's irony in the service of what? Because you're right. Like, dad's approach of, like, not really giving a shit. And just like, yeah, we'll get there when we get there.
It worked out just as well.
Also, they send the cops one time.
Yeah.
I felt like that's the other thing is, like, did the cops just stop taking their calls? Because, I mean... The Chicago Police Department does not come off very well in this film. They seem like not really giving a shit about a child being potentially endangered.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I get it. It's like, okay, we'll send a cop out there. And then you go and like, oh yeah, there's no one home. It's like, well, then it's even a bigger emergency because I definitely left my 8-year-old home alone. And none of the neighbors are home and they're all on vacation and he's probably dead or dying. Yeah. Like,
need to go interrogate old man Marley.
There you go. He's struck again.
Yep.
They've kick the door in or do something other than bang on the door and be like.
They could. The cops in this remind me of like the cops in Die Hard 2, like the airport cops, you know. They've got this lackadaisical attitude where, nothing.
Yeah,
nothing's gonna go wrong here. Everything's fine.
Yeah, the cops and the diehards are a particularly bad example. But yeah, I thought like the Chicago's finest are not didn't have their best weren't portrayed the maybe in the most flattering light.
No, for sure.
But also maybe someone from Chicago can explain this to me. But what's up with the police sporting the flag of Chicago? Mm. Why does Chicago have its own flag?
I don't know.
Like I'm sure a lot of cities do, but like I can't think of any other city I've been at that doesn't rock like the state. Maybe they got the state flag and of course the U.S. flag, but like, what's up with Chicago's 4-star baby blue and white flag? What do the 4 stars mean? Why is it such a big thing to you in Chicago? Are you going to secede from the union? These are things I would like to know about the Windy City.
I wish I could tell you. I wish. In my 6 months that I was there,
they're not going to they're going to open up to you.
That's
you're a fucking outsider.
I got to be a lifer. Yeah.
Were you flying the flag? Of course
no,
not.
No, I wasn't.
So, of course
but I don't know what it means. I'm
secrets.
Not going to fly a flag if I don't know what it means.
You have to, like, you have
it's
to.
It's a catch-22.
You have to be invited to the inner circle. You have to be there for at least 5 winters.
Okay.
And
you have to see at least one biggest winter blizzard on record.
You do. You do.
So every year it gets harder and harder,
right,
to get in that place.
Right. You have to have Facebook statuses involving lake effect snow.
Uh-huh.
And you have to have at least one Chicago flag. It's got to be pinned up in your bedroom. It's got to be on the bumper of your car. You got to fly the flag and then
I just can't.
The Chicago Illuminati, the Chicagonati comes out and and they take you to the secret L train track that gives you all the Chicago
secrets. Underground.
The original. See, it's not the second. That's the thing. They wanted to make you think the Chicago burnt down. This is the second city. Nah.
Oh,
nah.
Shit.
Old Chicago is still around.
It is. It's
literally underground. It's gone
sank
underground.
Sank a little. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I don't know. What am I going to this? There's going to be like bestial people living down there. They've got horns and hooves. And
I think so.
Right. They worship Marlon Brando. I mean, you got your own flag. Your police, your
I think Chicago essentially just has an upside down version of itself.
The original city.
Yep.
I don't got anything more to say about this film.
No, me either.
It's real. I actually think it's a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, it's a classic. It held up. I had a ton of fun
kids
watching
love
it.
My kid loved it. It's like one of the first movies, like old movie, because like this little shit. Whenever we sit down and watch a movie, he's like, when is this movie made? Because he's got like anything, like he doesn't like old movies because they look like shit.
They do.
Surprise, surprise. Yeah. I never thought to have the temerity when my mom sat me down to Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. They're like, who the fuck is this?
Yeah,
how old is this
fucking Beetle?
Yeah.
What kind of car are you?
Yeah, Herbie the Love Bug. Like, I never thought that question, like, or like when they sat down, like, hey, I want you to watch Little Rascals. I'd be like, fuck yeah, Little Rascals. Because I didn't have, like, you know, video games hadn't come down the pike yet.
Mm-hmm.
Like kids, yeah. Also kids entertainment was like precious back then. Like you mm-hmm. had morning cartoons and Saturday morning and that's it.
Yeah.
Nowadays a kid like between YouTube and Netflix and the Nickelodeons and the Cartoon Networks, like you're catered to 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
So you can afford to you can sneer at your parents' films and say, how old is this going to be? Am I going to see a Matt line in this? is this going to have puppets or stop motion animation? If so, I'm out. My imagination's broken from 1080p video games.
That's the thing. I feel like if this movie were made now, it would involve a whole hell of a lot of different technologies. Because the one of the things that makes this not work is 8-year-old Kevin McAllister doesn't have a fucking phone, A.
Doesn't have a cell phone.
He can't call anybody because the phone lines are down.
Right.
The other thing is he's using like micro machines and these mm-hmm. very like analog things. I feel like if it was made now, he'd have drones.
Sure.
He'd have like, he'd be researching shit on the internet. He'd like everything would change about this movie. Could keep the premise, but like everything would change.
You're right. And I think that's one of the things that's somewhat relatable because young kids still, it's kind of unusual for kids that are like not on the cusp of teenagers to have like cell phones. At least I think it is in the neck of the woods I'm at. Like that seems to be like, you know, you get to be 12 or 13 and then you get a cell phone maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But like I thought it was remarkable at how not dated the film looks from a child's point of view.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
other than the micro machines and like I don't think they call them micro machines in the movie. They're just little cars. Like there's nothing here that like screams, oh my God, this was 90s.
Don't they have the micro machines guy in it? Like on a commercial or something?
Maybe.
Or maybe we just talked about that.
I know we talked about that guy because you couldn't believe that he was still alive.
Right.
Turns out he is.
I thought the speed of his mouth killed him at some point.
Yeah, just the friction. The friction right. that close to the brain started a fire and he internally combust.
But even number two falls into that trap because it's got the talk boy. Do you remember the talk boy?
You talked about that, right.
Yeah, it's a essentially portable tape recorder that Kevin uses to get up to his antics and scare Tim Curry and surprise him and... all kinds of things, but even like the 2 years between Home Alone and Home Alone 2, mm-hmm. that technology has already like weasels its way into the movie. So now, like,
whereas this, there's nothing like every kid can relate to Christmas ornaments. Every kid can relate to like sticky shit and stepping on nails, and you can relate to blunt force trauma and getting your hands burned. And there's no like Teddy Ruxpin wasn't like the goddamn linchpin of a design or Simon. It's just like there's nothing that would make it like. And kids don't give a shit about wallpaper and interior design, so there's like nothing that super dates this film.
There wasn't even like a Nintendo system in there.
Right.
An NES.
Right. There wasn't any video games. So I feel like that that is one of the things that's going to work in its favor going into the future, because it's somewhat, it's going to be kind of somewhat timeless.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, video games and shit, like that's like when I watch Princess Bride and you see Fred Savage boot up his Commodore 64 to play baseball, it's like, holy shit, look at that fossil.
Yeah.
Like that goddamn fossil. Or you like, watch War original, or you something. Watch original Tron, or like, yeah, War Games or something like that. It's like, you know, great movie though. So this is the second phase of the Mary Culkin Keatmas. We'll be back, of course, this Friday. We've got another Christmas lunch extravaganza. Next week, we get back to the Keatmas part of the season. Batman Returns.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle Pfeiffer, Danny DeVito, also one of the ones that turned down the role of Harry.
Danny DeVito?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I bet he would have done a better job. He would have... I don't know. Danny DeVito from that era is a different animal.
Also, is Danny DeVito scary? Because Joe Pesci is able to be menacing.
Yeah, not really. You have to pair him with someone who's scarier.
I mean, he's kind of scary as the Penguin.
Maybe
that's something we can carry into next week when we talk about that. But like, yeah, we got Michelle Pfeiffer, of course, Michael Keaton, and man, Christopher Walken is in this movie.
Huh.
Billy Dee Williams, I believe, is still reprising his role as
holy shit.
As I think he plays Harvey Dent, actually. Yeah. Now that I think about it,
yeah, he does.
There's a lot of pretty high profile names.
Yeah.
Coming up with Batman Returns. But we'll be back next week for the live watch of that and the podcast. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Mary Culkin Keatmas.